And Tracy Manley.
Yes, the other half.
Better half. You know, through life, you meet interesting people, right? And I've been blessed to meet a lot of them. But the most interesting are often the ones who take their idea and make it into something and do it repeatedly over time. So that's why I thought it would be great to have Ray come talk about his world for many decades now, working with technology and roads and transport. And so there it is. Ray Mann, welcome to Madison Literary Club.
Well, other than my beautiful wife, there's two people in this room who've influenced me a great deal. One of them is Jim. Jim introduced me. My travel techniques, I all learned from Jim because he's so good at it. And he was a great influence in the first, there's about the second decade of our company. And then he spun off and had his own company. And then Rob Fisher over there, who just happens to be back from Mauritius. You know where that is?
Mauritius.
In the middle of the Indian Ocean. I mean, way out there. And Rob was an employee of mine until about a year and a half ago when his wife took a job at State Park. So great to see people. Caroline, of course, she's working full time now. She's brilliant. Just plugging along on some really tough stuff we got at the company. So I'm going to talk a little bit about, and I picked the title Autotopia and Beyond. I'm going to talk about what my business does, but more about how we are involved in all of the things that spread away from the business. So, you know, we're like a focal point for me, but it's opened up all kinds of doors. So first of all, we've been around for 4 decades. And as of 2 weeks ago, we hit our 41st year, so 41 years. So we're starting our fifth decade as a company. Just a little background on who we are. First of all, our goal is to be a single source and have infinite solutions. And that's going to kind of happen tonight. This is like drinking out of a fire hose, what I'm going to talk to you guys about tonight. There's way more depth, and I have all kinds of writings on the depth, but I'm going to try to cover everything, just touch on a few things lately. First of all, our organization works for state DOTs, municipals around the country. We collect pavement data, asset encroachment, you know, so those fires that get started when the power lines get hit. So we do asset inventories. We've got a huge project with the state of California right now, right-of-way imaging, and then intersection modeling. So we can make 3D models of intersections, and then the coming future, we're going to have connected intersections. We actually have two connected corridors here in Madison, Wisconsin, and we do all the mapping that goes into that, so the intelligence piece of that. And then, of course, at the end there, we got curb and grade, which is how the road is, you know, the trajectory on the road is here. So you can see my fleet of vehicles. This is the type of vehicle we deploy. I just sent three of them down to Georgia, and they're starting their first week down there. But what we do is we have a bank of sensors on the vehicle. LIDAR, which creates a 3D model of everything using light. So it sends out laser beams and brings back as photons. And we do imagery. We use 45 megapixel cameras. So we're doing about a circle around the van. It's roughly about 135 megapixels of data. Now, that's a lot. You know, even your iPhone only has 12. You can get some of the Android phones that have 45 megapixels. We do that all the way around the vehicle with three cameras. We do pavement. We scan pavement at 70 miles an hour down to 1 millimeter. Caroline does some of that processing for me. And what we can do is we can create texture maps of the pavements that we drive over. So we do, you know, 100,000, 150,000 miles of that a year. And we can tell the DOTs exactly how their pavements perform, where it is in its useful lifetime. We also have to have, there are all these sensors, you have to have something that keeps track of all the bounce and stuff in the vehicle. So we have global positioning, which gives us super accurate location, and the IMU, which collects all of the vibration that's going on, and then we can eliminate that from the solution. And then we have to process it. On the back end, we do data reduction. We bring all that data in. It's all labeled, and it's on threads that attach to global positioning, the geolocation. It allows us to be able to process that and make sense out of it and pass it on to our customers. So the people we work with universities across the country. Yes, Hawaii is one of them. We have all kinds of associations and partners that we work with in the industry. Two of them I'm really proud of. One is the Wisconsin ACES. This is an organization that tries to spread knowledge about all things autonomous, connected, electric, and shared mobility. And we sponsor a group called the AV Forum. The Navy Forum has a meeting in Milwaukee on the 27th of this month. Anybody wants to call, I can get you information about that. We also started an institute out in Hawaii, and Rob was the one that really helped me build the Hawaii Autonomous Vehicle Institute and the Illinois Mobility Consortium, which is an equivalent to the autonomous vehicle industry in the state of Illinois. We are founders of these different organizations. So we're really out there to try to spread the word. We're also proud of the people we work with. So you got Illinois, there's Nevada, Louisville, sent a vehicle down to Mexico, Kansas. I have their vehicles in right now. Regional Transit Commission of Southern Nevada, which is the Las Vegas region. So very interesting projects. U.S. Postal Service, going to be the last mile collection system engineer. So let's talk about my title, Autotopia. And there was a little bit of confusion about this.
Great.
But
question. What
does autonomous mean? Autonomous means that people don't have to control it. It's got a built-in knowledge base. They can make decisions without having any kind of human interaction. So if you have an autonomous connected corridor, what it's going to do is going to keep track of all the cars and kind of sort it out so that people don't have to make decisions at the last moment. It's looking at the big picture and trying to
see. The thing that Tesla has that doesn't quite work on it.
good description.
Exactly. Now, are these the people who are doing, setting up the roads and all? Or is it...
It's all kinds of different levels.
Awesome.
Yeah, you have to be really versatile because you have to be able to speak the language in each of the different levels and bring it all together. And there are people who are way out here and you have to reach out and try to make sure that they understand that they're part of a community, a system, and a lot of different pieces are put together. So Autotopia, for those of you who don't know what that is, it's a ride that debuted in Disneyland on July 17, 1955. That's exactly 4 years before I was born. The attraction reflects the mid-20th century fascination with automobiles, and it was inspired by the car culture that was coming out of post-war America and Walt Disney's own enthusiasm for technology and innovation. If you ever wonder about that, you get to San Francisco, go to the Walt Disney Family Museum in the Presidio. He was so, so diverse in what he created in the world. And that's one of the few places you go and you can see it about all the overhead of Mickey Mouse. Mickey Mouse's part. So let's talk about the history of roads. First of all, we have a lot of roads in this country, and I think there's 4 million roads with about 2.7 million of roads with pavement on them. And, the history of roads starts out with early indigenous trails. Now, I'm from Portage, Wisconsin. That's where I grew up. And as a Boy Scout in Portage, Wisconsin, we did the Marquette Trail. As an adult, I took kids on the Marquette Trail. One of the original trails, they had the tricentennial when I was in high school. So the early indigenous trails. Then they create colonial roads. Those were roads that were some of these trails, but widened a little bit so they could get more passage. After the Revolutionary War, we started thinking, well, we got to designate roads. So the Cumberland Road was developed between Washington, D.C. and Ohio. And then we started having canals and railroad. Now, the funny thing is, if you come from Portage, Wisconsin, we have a canal there. And it runs right along the Marquette Trail. The problem was they finished the canal and it was obsolete because the railroad came to town and built a bridge right over the top. So the Great Portage was no longer a bottleneck between Lake Michigan and the Mississippi River. Then came the automobile age. The automobile age started in the late 1800s and it really changed things. And you think about all the people who were doing carriages with horses and stuff, and that was their form of employment. And the car comes along, and they go, oh, that thing's never going to last. And it didn't take long. It was like a two-year period in New York City, and all of a sudden, horses were disappearing. And they had actual lots where they took the horse manure and stacked it, and those lots became available to put buildings on. So there was a big push to get that real estate back. And there's something similar to that as we move to autonomous vehicles. And then the interstate highway system, our president Eisenhower decided that we needed to have a network of roads across the country that would allow us to be able to move any place we needed to go safely, and also as a tool for our military in case we had to deploy and move resources very, very quickly. So today we have the expansion and maintenance side of the roads. And you know, I saw today 94 down in Milwaukee, just Friday, got approval. They're going to do an expansion on 94. I think it's that section between State Fair Park and downtown. So we continue to do that. But if you're going to have expansion and maintenance, you need to pay for your roads. So how do we pay for the roads? Traditionally, we've had a fuel tax. And the fuel tax, you know, it's been able to take care of things. It's been helpful. We still put some you know, regular budget money into it. But, you know, it's given us the chance to be able to collect money. And our national gas tax in the United States is a federal excise tax. It's 8.4 cents per gallon on gasoline and 24.4 cents per gallon on diesel fuel. You know, because our trucks are bigger and it's kind of a use tax that way. Great thing about the fuel tax is we're all used to it. It doesn't interfere with anything. In Wisconsin, it's 30.9 cents per gallon for both gasoline and diesel. So you can see a considerable part, you know, literally almost 40 cents a gallon, or every gallon of fuel we have is going to the tax to help pay for roads. But the roads are very expensive and all the things that go with it. And it's also funding mass transit and some of the things that we're doing, like the bus rapid transit here in Madison. So these alternative funding methods help governments address the challenge associated with the declining fuel tax. Yes, it is. We're having troubles now. We're not collecting the same amount because our cars are getting more fuel efficient and we've got electric vehicles out there. So they have some different approaches on how they want to collect that money. So we'll take a look at some of those here. So first of all, how do we pay for roads? We all know about it when we go across the border, the tolls. And here in Wisconsin, we've been fighting that for ever. I don't think that's going to last a whole lot longer. Mileage-based user fees, I think, is a better way to do this. You know, all of us have phones in our cars, and believe it or not, if you bought a car after 2019, that car has a radio and can transmit information from your car. In fact, it transmits a lot of information from your car. And one of those things is your mileage. So we could just turn that on, create an app that would collect your mileage. So you'd have to pay by what the weight of your fuel is, some of the absolutes it has, what kind of fuel mileage it gets. So we could make that very defined as to how each person has to pay for it. We have vehicle registration fees. As all of you know, we've had a car over the last 10 years in Wisconsin, our vehicle registration fees quite a bit up. State County has a special tax. City of Madison begins next year.
Yes, we do.
Yeah. There are public-private partnerships. Now, this is like the thing that if you talk to people in government, they love this because it's basically putting the burden on financing it to investment people. I think this is nuts in some ways because what you're doing is giving them permission to basically come in and take the right-of-way, which is a public right-of-way, and get control of it. And then they're going to charge you whatever they want to charge. So, you know, certainly the side contract. Like the toll road, it's known as the Skyway. The company that bought that got a 75 degrees. They paid $75 million for it, but the road is worth it in the long run. So value capture, if you have an area that has, like, we have Epic on here, just on the other side of Verona, and they built that big interchange to get to Epic. That's a value proposition, and you can charge people in the area who are going to use that exit. Epic probably... they probably got it as some sort of TIF financing or something, but you know, the public price set money aside that they could use the correct capture value of what how that was valuable. Alternative funding sources, there's a lot of different ways to add taxes, like the city of Madison tax and stuff. Carbon pricing, you know, if we're going to keep using gasoline and we're trying to control our carbon output, that's a good way to charge people who are going to do that a lot more money. And then grants and federal funding, which is paying for the fast transit, like the bus rapid transit, some of the programs for rail, light rail, and things of that nature. Okay, so we're going to talk a little bit about our mobility, you know, today and tomorrow. First of all, let's talk about EVs. The EV industry experienced some really rapid growth in the last couple of years. You know, there's significant advancements going on. However, there's still challenges and hurdles that it's facing and continue to face going forward. Now, this was the first year that we had winter, and we had a lot of EVs. And guess what people found out? batteries when they're cold do not get as much mileage. And it was alarming. A lot of people who bought EVs are very disappointed in how their vehicle performed in that stretch in January. You know, it just don't get the range that you were looking for. So, you know, I think that's one of the things. Infrastructure. In Wisconsin, we have $85 million to place infrastructure. And if any of you are watching the government conversation about this, there's a bill that's in place, and the power companies have made it so that none of us can create our own power and sell it because we're not utilities. And there's a big fight going on, and I don't know how it's going to get resolved, but they're also saying that no public organization can give tier three charging, that's fast charging. So that means if we spend that $85 million and we put chargers in at the courthouse or, you know, up and down the streets. In L.A., they're putting them on light poles.
Mm-hmm.
We do that in Wisconsin. You can only get tier two charging, which means you'd have to be there for 8 hours. So, you know, I think infrastructure is going to be a big deal. The battery technology is evolving. We're starting to get into layered flat batteries. They're much denser in terms of how they can hold the charge. But the cost for these materials is off the charts until we find ways to find the minerals and things to do that. That also adds some, like you say, that changes, you know, our pollution output also, because the batteries are very costly. Range anxiety, that's probably the biggest reason everybody's struggling with EVs. You know, I don't even look at an EV unless it gets over 300. I've been asked by the state of California to take my fleet of five vehicles and turn them into EVs. They said that would look really good for us. And I went, my vehicles go 400 miles a day sometimes. There's no way I could do that in snow. So range anxiety is really a big pressure point. Policy and regulation, I talked about that a little bit with some of the laws that are in place. Consumer education, it's amazing how much misinformation there is. And so we started with Wisconsin ACES or WE-ACES because there's so much misinformation. We're trying to gather the truth and get it in place. We don't go out to make money. We're not trying to just go out there and do something fun for ourselves. It's crazy how much misinformation is out there. Supply chain challenges. You know, we tried to buy a car a year and a half ago. You had to wait 6 months to get an electric car. You just weren't enough parts to be able to do it. So despite these challenges, the electric vehicle industry continues to make significant strides. It's driven by technological advancements, growing environmental awareness, supportive government policies. That was a big one. The Biden administration and Congress did a great job getting that in place. Ongoing innovation and collaboration across sectors, the transition to electric mobility is expected to accelerate in coming years. Now, it's a little bit of an asterisk on this, and that is that the car companies had committed to do it by certain times. So 2025 was one of the goals. 2030 was one of the calls. And now we're seeing the car companies pull back because range anxiety, cold weather, all these things that, you know, and you can't drive across the country and find tier three chargers. So we've lost a little momentum. We had this big inertia that occurred and we're losing that momentum. So it's a little frustrating to see where we are right now. Ford is not going to make as many F-150 Lightnings. Probably isn't the best place for us to do an electric vehicle to pick up trucks like that. But, you know, it was a cool thing. A lot of guys who had trucks thought, oh, I can go really fast without realizing I can't go more than 300 miles and then have to sit around for 8 hours. So, you know, I think there's a lot of pieces to this puzzle. We have to try to be patient to make sure that even though we've lost momentum, that we don't let it become, you know, fallow and not continue to grow. So let's talk about autonomous vehicles. This is one of my favorite subjects. I'm a big fan of this. Autonomous vehicle industry was progressing steadily with some challenges and setbacks. I'm going to talk about some of the things that have gone on with this. But first of all, autonomous vehicles, I believe we're doing it wrong. I think we try to make cars as we know them become autonomous vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
What we really should have done is looked at autonomous mobility and how we can make that work. Because of that, we're running into a glass ceiling that we can't get past. Brick walls there. Everybody's at that point and nobody knows how to push through it. because they're still dragging along big ass car behind me. So we're going to see some, there's going to be some turbulent times with the autonomous vehicle here. Instead of going to the full autonomous driving, we're talking about tier three. Tier three is a little dangerous because it makes you hold your hands on the wheel. And if you lose the tension, you know, the car will stop, stuff like that. It's more, much more complex. A lot of you have tier two already. Anybody who has an automated cruise control, that's considered tier two. That is autonomous. But we have a lot of pieces of this puzzle we have to sort out. So let's talk a little bit about what's kind of getting in the way on this. So we have technology development. We're doing a lot here. A lot of the systems I use, in fact, I make HD maps for autonomous vehicles. So the HD map is the knowledge. Like if you were going to drive to work, you don't need a map to drive to work. You just know how to get to work. If you take an HD map and put it inside the car, the car knows the layout. It only looks for what's in motion or in real time. So a person's on a bike here. There's a car coming that way. You know, there's some rain coming. Or pavement's got a heat and earth on one. Those are things in real time. You don't need to use all your CPU cycles to reinvent everything every time you go out. You have this map that's inside the car that tells you what to expect, and then you go for what you don't expect. Mm-hmm. So technological development is progressing, but we're also still running into a little bit of a problem. Testing and deployment. This has been crazy. About a month and a half ago, a bunch of people attacked a Waymo autonomous vehicle in Chinatown in San Francisco. One of the ways you can stop a Waymo vehicle is you can take a cone, for construction, put it on the hood, and it freaks out. There's a company called Cruise, which is General Motors. And when Cruise had a whole fleet deployed, they had an accident, and the police came up to the car, and of course, there's no driver in it. Once the car thinks everything's okay, it takes off. They started chasing the car. We're deploying these robo taxis right now. You know, that's one of the things that I think is going to be really valuable. But we still have a lot of work in our testing environment. I mean, why is nobody doing this in Chicago or New Jersey where it snows and it gets cold and it's sloshy and crazy? Everybody's doing this in places where, at worst, it rains. You know, Arizona's been a big place. So we need to get better at what we're doing for testing and implement that. The regulatory landscape is awesome. Right now, I can't do a vehicle in Wisconsin where it doesn't have a driver beyond the steering. So even if I built something that was autonomous, I still have to have a person in the car. I have to pay them to be in the car, which is making it more expensive to do it. So, you know, we have to figure out the rules, and we have to kind of get the whole country in the same place and get it working. But also remember, regionally, we have all kinds of different things that autonomous vehicles are going to have to address. Safety and public perception. It goes back to the crash in Arizona where there was a woman who was crossing the road with her bike coming through a bush medium, and an autonomous vehicle from Uber hit her, killed her. Now, first of all, she came out of the medium in bushes, and the car had no time to respond. Mm-hmm. What was really crazy about that is the public perception of it's really bad is Uber had turned off the automatic alert because they were having problems. When the car would go, that it would see something and it would try to stop, and that would put it would turn off the autonomous system, and they keep track of the counts. And it was happening too often, so they turned off automatic braking. If they would have left automatic braking on, she would not have been left. The car would have stopped again. So that's been a big problem. Partnerships and collaborations all over the map on this. What went wrong with this industry is there was just a ton of money dumped on it. All kinds of money just spent frivolously. And so we burned off an immense amount of cash. Countries like Japan, they formed a digital map corporation and they financed to put it all together. And they're doing it in unison. China's starting to get there also. Here in the United States, everybody wants to be a living. So they don't want to share and they don't want to get together. And because of that, we're seeing companies in the autonomous sector are failing at a rate of, it's going to be probably 70% of all companies that started 5 years ago. They're burning through cash too fast. So we need to be better with our partnerships and collaborations. We also don't understand the commercial applications. If we want to do this as robo taxis and stuff like that, trying to, you know, emulate what Uber and Lyft do, we need to figure out how to monetize that. And we're struggling with that. So we've got to really think about it. One area where I think autonomy is probably going to hit the quickest is in large semi trucks carrying stuff in the supply chain. In fact, they're already using them. They're fully put in place. I think you're going to see this. It's the thing that's going to happen over the next 4 or 5 years, which will prove a lot of this technology. We have a real shortage of truck drivers. It's a very terrible job. I've been to a meeting to listen to the truck drivers talking. Like, it's somewhere in the 80% of them are divorced, male, female. They die at an average age of 65. Their health, it's just not a great thing. We need to supplement that with, you know, technology that will make that a much better life for these people. Challenges and setbacks, we talked a little bit about that. And investments and funding. Man, I can tell you, if you said the term autonomous, you probably could have got $10. It was that bad. The investment was just like, you know, anybody who wanted things. I actually had a company that came to me who said, we'd like you to run our company. And I said, well, I'm not Steve Jobs. He said, no, you're more like Tim Cook. Made all money for Apple. And I asked him, what should I do with, you know, I have this company I'm running already. I said, no, just dump that. I did a little research, and they were, you know, investment, they were venture. And then what they were trying to do is they were trying to get a company started so they could sell a company. Mm-hmm. So it was going to be this quick turnaround. That's what's killing this industry. And everybody's trying to get in and get their piece of it. And some of the best companies I've ever worked with are no longer in existence because somebody decided they were going to do a SPAC, and the people who invested in the SPAC took it, and they took a bunch of cash out of it, and they left it as a whole. And to that end, you know, the LiDAR company that started the industry and I've worked really closely with is no longer in existence. I can't even buy their LiDAR heads anymore. So, you know, they were revolutionary. They came off that. So, you know, the autonomous vehicle industry has hit a snag. It's lost a lot of momentum. Certainly Tesla has their system that everybody who drives one and is using it, you're in beta mode. You have to realize. And even if you pay the $12,000 to get it turned on, if you have 3 times where they catch you without your hands on the steering wheel, you lose it for 3 months.
Ooh.
So, yeah, it's they're getting serious because they've had a lot of weird things happen with it. But even though there's significant hurdles, I think this is really important we get to autonomy because we lose over 40,000 people a year to car accidents. And the injury rate is even more than that. And I study car accidents. Every time there's a car accident that I can get data on, I worry about it. And 80% of all car accidents are human error. Now, if we could lower that down to 10%, think of how many lives we could make better by just having that piece of it. I'm trying to think, there was an accident on John Nolan Drive. I just drove right off the road. God, the hardware in his car didn't fail or anything. He drove off the road the other day. I saw an accident a week ago Friday where I was driving up on 94 just for Tallman. And there was a pickup truck in a blaze and guardrail for 40 feet was destroyed. There was nothing wrong with Rilla. There was nothing wrong with his truck. He either fell asleep or he dropped his phone or something, hit that guardrail, put the truck home. He did not spot it. Those are the things. I think one day, 2 years ago, there were 5 deaths between Park Street and just north of Middleton. There were 5 deaths in 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Every one of them was a driver. Not one of them was equipment. Not one of them was weather. So I think autonomy will make us safer. And it's not just the person who causes the accident, people who are involved in other ways. It's a better thing. So we need to push towards this. So let's talk about shared mobility. And this is an area that I really concentrated on. Rob and I spent a lot of time talking about this in the smart city side of things. So the shared mobility industry was experiencing challenges and opportunities influenced by various factors, including technological advancements, changing consumer preferences, pandemic had and regulatory developments. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what's going on in the shared mobility industry. So first of all, we all know about Uber and Lyft, ride-hailing services. And those of us who can use them, not during rush times and stuff, actually, it's pretty good value. I compared it to, it's just in Denver. And for the four of us, we were much better taking Uber than taking the light rail all the way down. It was about $10 savings and took half the time. So, and I'll talk a little bit about where I see this all going, because I think there's a huge a piece of this puzzle that's going to come together when we connect everything. Yep. So ride-hailing services have their value, but I can tell you there's times I look at what the price is, and I think I'll just walk. We have micro-mobility solutions. We've all seen, do we have scooters in Madison?
I think they're dead. They were here and gone.
In some cities, like if you have a convention city, San Diego is a great example. It's the first place, like Tracy and I were down there for a conference, a GIS conference. Scooters were all over the place. There's three companies, and at the end of the day, there was a scooter. People would come and pick them all up, take them home and charge them and bring it back by 6 cents a day. If you were at the convention center, your hotel was a mile and a half away, and even though San Diego is the best weather in the world, if you had your backpack on and walked back to your hotel that mile, you were going to be all sweaty. Would jump on that scooter. Maybe 10 minutes, you're back, no sweat. There's a lot of ways that can work. What I think is actually more powerful is electric bikes. And I love to see what we're doing here in Madison with electric bikes, because you can go a long ways with those. You can take on 5, maybe 6 miles. And that's the kind of mobility that we really need to be looking at to get things in a way that people will be able to do what they need to do. Car sharing programs, we have that here. We've got the park and ride lots all over. So car sharing is a way to do it. Subscription services, your car companies don't want you to own the car. They're working really hard. They're mobility companies. They want you to pay a subscription service, and they're already doing that. If you buy a General Motors car, you have a $1,500 cost on the sticker. And that's for 3 years of OnStar, so that they can be in your dashboard monitoring everything you're doing. But also, at the end of that 3 years, if you don't pay the next $500, they'll turn off your AutoStar, they'll turn off your seat heaters, they'll turn off all kinds of different things. So they want it to be a subscription service, because that's where they can take the cost out. Maybe make the threshold to get into a car less expensive, but it's a way for them to have a new way to be able to generate revenue. Autonomous vehicles and AVs, this is what I was talking about in San Francisco. LA is going to get this from Waymo too. They're doing robotic taxis. The other thing is, I don't always have my car with me. Now, if I took mass transit, but I got to do something now, I can't use mass transit. We have all these cars. You sit them in parking lots or in your garage. Like 90% of the time, your car isn't even doing it. What if we could have a service where you could go on your phone and call it and the car comes to you? So similar to ride-hailing services, but now you're just hailing the car, and the car is in the area, and it'll come to pick you up and take you places. There's just a couple of cities that have that in place right now, watching it carefully to see how it works out. Integration with the public transit, this is a big deal. I've been to 3 cities now just since the beginning of the year. We've been doing integration where, if you have a bike, they make sure you can take that bike. If you're going to do a long run, you can go on the train, or you can go on the bus. They can tell you if there's scooters available. So this is part of a program that we refer to in the industry as the mobile MDS, mobile data services.
Specification.
Yeah, specification. This is where the cities get smart and everything is connected. And you can pull it together and you can figure out what mobility you want to be using. Again, we still have the regulatory challenges. A lot of cities, they won't have scooters because people just leave the scooters to go over. They have a hazard. Financial viability is, if I build this system, will they come and will they pay? And then a shift to consumer behavior. The pandemic was epic. I'm in my fifth decade of work in this industry, and I've never seen something changing perception of people as the pandemic. you know, it wasn't like the Depression. I mean, people were dying, and we were, you know, we had to do certain things, but, you know, most of us, it worked out okay. It wasn't like a world war or anything like that, or, you know, people who came before us had Depression, World War, you know, other things like that. But it, I think, changed us as a society in a way that we won't recover. We won't be who we were a lot of times. But that shift in consumer behavior, we're just starting to.
What is it?
First of all, people don't want to leave their homes. They don't want to work in a regular environment anymore. People have gotten connected to their computers, so losing that connection with each other. And we want to have instant, you know, the Amazon thing. We want to have something delivered instantly to our house. So people, I know people who never go shop the groceries anymore.
How does that affect cars?
Well, we use our cars to fill that void. You know, so if we wanted to do something, we'd get in the car and we'd go do it. People are doing that now. They're having things delivered to them. They don't go to work anymore. So in the morning, they don't have to shower. They can sit behind their computer and put a fake background up. And,
yep. That's how we do all our things now.
You can put an avatar on the screen. So, you know, people don't have to travel. We're not traveling as much. There are days on the Beltline.
It also ended up causing more lethal traffic accidents.
Yes, it did.
So those were less empty. Some people were driving faster on roads.
Running through Stella.
Yeah.
I think that if you drive down the Beltline from Middleton to McFarland and exit 51, if you don't have one person pass you at over 90 miles an hour,
it's a miracle.
Yeah. Because they're coming fast. In fact, I was told by the police, if somebody passes you at 100 and they're weaving around, it's usually a stolen car being moved from the west side of town to the east side of town. That's rampant in Madison right now. Stolen cars from the west side is just, it's off the charts. You have a Kia or a Hyundai, you're taking those and moving them all over to the east side.
So the question, if we're driving less, do we become poorer drivers?
Yes, you know. Yes, we do. Because without practice, we're losing some of those skills. How many times have you gone up to like an intersection, a four-way stop, and saw a four-way stop? People are going through red lights.
Yes.
People aren't staying in their lane anymore. Well, because one, they got their phone at school. Yeah. That's going to slip off their thigh while they're trying to look at it. you know, we are worse drivers on a whole. Now, I don't know if you guys are. I'm not going to say you're the worst driver, but just go out and look.
Can you find that all over the country?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We have a lab here at the University of Wisconsin called the TOPS Lab. And it's transportation. You know, they're doing all this research. Some of the numbers are coming out for reasons. In fact, time of day, the women have accidents is compared to men. Actually, and are separating it at that level. You know, it's different. It's different perspectives. So I don't want to say necessarily it's a little bit on a whole. More women are having accidents during certain hours of the day. So it's, you know, we're starting to see that. As I said, we're just starting to tap into what the pandemic did to us.
So do men have more accidents than the time of day?
Yes, they do. And they have worse accidents.
Interesting.
But if you look on the Beltline now, you'll find that they're probably being passed by a young woman who's driving well over the speed limit on the belt. It's that I've noticed since the pandemic is that, especially it looks like women under the age of 40 are passed on by. And part of that is they don't have the, you know, people are losing, you know, that mentality. You know, they think of themselves as someone who's, well, I'm not good. It's not going to hurt me. I'm going to be okay. But all you need is somebody to have a car in front of you and have a tire go flat. They start saving all over and get money car accidents. That's pretty quick.
I have a question about driving. And it's a very interesting aspect of doing the work at your company, data processing, especially with line work, that I feel, and then I have to correct myself, that I can interpret these roads, I can figure out what, and sometimes it's easy, sometimes it's kind of complicated. parts of Illinois they found what they were doing as a grad. So it makes me aware of the value. It's a different kind of value of knowing how to draw. The other part of it is, it makes me realize I like to draw. So, and that's the other side. Now, I was shocked to hear, like, in support of what you're saying, that there are young people who are just not interested in learning to draw.
There are.
But those of us who do, because aging populations, a lot of us still like to draw. What's going to happen with the shift toward autonomous vehicles? Because there's going to have to be, that's one thing could go on your list, that you're not, it will not be possible, I would venture to say, you could, I would accept another argument, but I wouldn't like it. It will not be possible. It will not be possible. I'm so grateful for that smart as hell. It's like, it will not be possible just to develop autonomous vehicles, which are going to do best when they're interacting with each other. They have all sorts of signaling systems. They can understand how they think. Human drivers baffle them. I mean, baffle each other to get used to each other. So there's going to have to, you can't just tell people, okay, nobody is allowed to drive in a car. That would, I mean.
Okay, so we have to make some decisions here.
There's going to be, the cultural change. There's going to be, but there's probably going to be a long period of overlap until enough people, you know, the people who like to drive die off.
Well, first of all,
I'd like to get address this question.
Yeah. So first of all, Tracy and I have grandchildren, and roughly around 2 years of age, they're sitting there pushing a car on the floor, making the motor cups. So that's not going to happen with electric cars. And we're probably not going to get to drive.
Yes.
But they already know that at 2 years of age. They already know that a car makes that noise. And,
right. Okay.
And that they want to drive. Or they want to be able to have control. As Americans, we have that. It's part of our culture, and it's really hard to weed that off.
It is.
But the reality is, as a community, there are things we're going to have to do to make ourselves better.
Okay.
And to make ourselves better, that means we're going to have to give up some of our rights. It doesn't mean we have to, you know, completely stop driving, but maybe we have places where you can drive and places where everything's going to be automated. So if you build a car that has both those features in it, you know, think about this once. You drive on the Beltline, it's a crazy mess. But people are all different lengths apart and stuff. What if you can move every car with kind of foot of each other?
Oh, yeah.
So all traveling at the same time. Your capacity. Yeah. Why build another lane?
Right.
Build another lane on the Beltline. Well, what we need
is big
cars to drive the speed limit and closer together.
So it's like a train.
Yes, it actually is. So that's why I say, how we treat autonomous vehicles. We kept thinking, we're thinking now about them as being individual cars. What we really need to do is think about them as the bees in the hive. You need to get them to communicate with each other.
Mm-hmm.
So the caveat there is, all that information goes somewhere. So one, first of all, how do we keep it secure? Number two, how do we keep it from being used against us?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you have Geico, I'm trying to think which insurance companies give you the little thing to put on your cars, your EV sensor. They check all the times you're speeding, all the times that you're stopping on the brakes really hard and stuff like that. They collect all that information in real time. It's being sent to their server. So when they profile you, they can determine what rate they're going to charge you because of the way you drive. Now, you may not have had an accident in 10 years, but if you're somebody who's driving down the Beltline 12 miles over the speed limit every day, or driving in a neighborhood where it's 25, you're driving 35, they can geolocate you with that system. It's only about this big. You get, the insurance company sends it to you, and they'll give you a lower rate if you put it in. But it's, what it's doing is it's profiling it. I was at a conference, it was an autonomous vehicle conference, and the telcos were saying, you should make all the cars be on AT&T and Verizon. There's a Verizon guy saying, guy from Mercedes got up. He said, no way are we going to let you guys be in our dashboards. We're going to control the dashboard because there's value in being the person collecting the information about the people in the car and then turning around and inundating with advertisements.
Mm-hmm.
Like, coming into a city, there's an accident, and there's McDonald's over there.
Oh,
all of a sudden, the burger shows up on your screen. So, hey, you can go here and do that. So that's one of those things why the subscription service is going to get weird, because they're going to try to pay for it.
Oh, God.
You know, I look at our lives as we have so many life cycles. You know, every day, we probably have 10,000 life cycles. And it's business. They make money off of interrupting those life cycles and drawing them away from the person who's have to see that as being sinful that they're doing that to you. But that's the reality. That's how things are getting paid for. And there are parts of our society where they can be triggered to do that really well. So why wouldn't you put that in the cars when people are sitting there and it's driving by itself, going down the road? You can shop it all over Amazon or whatever inside the car while you're having you.
So if you came to a four-way cross, would the cars talk to each other enough? Say, you go first, you go first, just second, third.
Yes, sir.
And the driver would have no recourse and overriding.
And they would actually know enough early enough that if all four of you came to the intersection, it would almost be like going through a circle. They would all pace each other just enough so that you could really keep everybody going. As I said, there's an app, and I hope they put it out for the Park Street corridor that you can have on your phone so you can see how the Park Street corridor is working. And it'll tell you what speed to get at so that you can get through the lights. So you don't drive too fast to stop. Just turn your car too fast. So they would, they can do that. That's all built into the connected vehicle corridors. And autonomous vehicles do that. I think the easiest way to explain that is this: when you come up to an intersection and you're going to cross or turn on that intersection, the car that's coming on your left, you don't know what. You don't know how fast they're going. I mean, you guess, but you don't know. If you had a car that was talking to that car, it would tell you what their intent is and how the car is going to respond. So your car would make the decision: I'm either going to go because I have no space, that car's going to give me space, or I'm going to stay here because that car's going to give me space. So the cars will sit there and they'll do that in real time, just like we do. They're fast enough now. The computer technology is easily fast enough to do that.
Well, we have all these autonomous cars. So it makes us the owner car, or do you just have a few autonomous cars on the block and you take turns using them?
Well, there's a couple of things there. First of all, I think we're going to no longer have power plants, big power plants. They'll be for industry, but we as communities put solar on our roof and have gas generators, maybe even heat pumps to grow up. And what we'll do as a neighborhood is we'll generate energy and we'll have a battery in the neighborhood. Everybody will be able to take off that battery. So we charge our cars and we're not reliant on the big system. Same thing with the cars. I don't think everybody's going to have a car. And what you'll do as a neighborhood is you'll sit down and decide how many people need to go. You just need to get to some place where you can distribute, trade off, and the intelligence is there. The AI is there to help us get there. The one thing that we would have to give up is the privacy of being in our car in the morning with our coffee or whatever while we're singing a song off the radio. Those are the things that we'd have to give up. But if you've ever been to the city, New York City, I ride the trains when I go visit my son in New York City. It's exactly how we should be doing it. I think the BRT is a good start, but I'm a firm believer that the rail system should go, the high-speed rail should go to the airport. They should add a light rail system to the port of the city.
Yes.
The distribution from there. When they decided to bring the high-speed rails downtown Madison, that was a mistake because now you're taking a train that's supposed to travel at 125 miles an hour. You're slowing it down to 15 to bring it downtown, and that's going to take a half hour. Crossing all those crosswalks. Right. So if they would, they're going to bring Amtrak in, and I think they're going to put it out by Oscar Mayer. And then I think the BRT is going to manage people coming off of that, the downtown and distribution. So we'll have some.
That's really
good. Well,
I think
I'm going to I can't believe the cost of this. First of all, it was way cheaper to do it by bus because rubber is a lot cheaper than putting steel and steel rails. But we'll get to find out. It's really close. I've seen the bus drivers out practicing with the new buses. They're big articulated buses, dark blue. So I'll see the new BRT buses.
With doors on both sides?
Yes, doors on both sides. I don't know why they put the stops in the middle of the street, though. There's some kinds of logic I'm fighting with here.
In the ride of drive off, in the block off, we're seeing these things. This is never going to work. Someone's going to get killed.
Absolutely. We've had a few people run over by bus in the last 5 years, so
yeah,
we'll have to see if it makes a difference. it certainly, by consolidating our mainline route, it makes distribution much easier. So we'll see if they pull it off. But, you know, I know the guy who runs the corridor, the Carsten corridor, and they actually, the lights on Johnson Street, they can run all those from a single computer. And during special events like games and stuff like that, they set up the lights to go a certain direction. I have a bone to pick with him because he always takes where West Wash and Park Street come together. Tracy knows this. I get so frustrated. And he doesn't let enough cars go through. It's like he only grabs a bunch and then he stops the light down by St. Mary's. It's like, what are you doing here? You gotta clear the, you know, clear the trough.
Yeah.
And then hold people instead of sitting there and breaking it up into a bunch of pieces.
So coming back from the airport up to Sherwood where we are, it's late at night. You never have to start. When you solve this, it's synchronized perfectly. And why can't that be done?
Well, some of it is concern for the beltline. So what they're always trying to do is they're trying to hesitate the flow to the beltline so that there's always time for the beltline clear. So that you're moving traffic, you know, traffic coming into. So a fish hatchery coming out of Fitchburg, you have to stop at every single light from PD to the belt. Every single light.
Must be 20 lights.
All in a set so that you can only get to the next light. And what that does, it clears out the trough between that light and the last light. But it's, I come over to Seminole and take Seminole. I go over and take 14 because it's too frustrating.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I had an autonomous vehicle, I would just sit there and ignore it. The fact that I haven't paid attention, that's hard.
Okay. Right. One other question about how they make the cars. And, of course, now it is changing with the cars are kind of pretty much nondescript. But they used to be a real expression of those personalities.
Yes, they did.
You have that possession aspect. That business about bringing the the steering car, whatever. I guess it will fade away as the cars get more and more understood. But there used to be. I mean, it's a real American thing.
Oh, yeah, true. Yeah.
True. I guess it'll just die out gradually.
Well, we have more people living in New York City who don't have cars. We'll adjust. We'll figure it out. We'll adjust.
Is this going to be more of a city country divide, too?
So I'm working on a project in Iowa. It's called the Rural Initiative. What we did is we did there's an autonomous bus. It was built by the University of Iowa. We supplied an airstrip. So we did 80 miles with the routes. And they're in their fourth year of this thing. So we see a real value in having autonomy going out and bringing people in from the farm to the city. We think that's this, especially people who are a little more aged, not have to have a vehicle that's sitting on the farm, so if you only have two vehicles, one this way, one that, so that third person then will have these. So we've been working on that project, and the final version of that study is coming out, but everything we've shown has been absolutely, this is probably a better market than the city market.
Are we seeing buses or?
It's an autonomous, it's a like an airport bus, transit vehicle with the seats on it, and it drives the whole route autonomous.
Oh, it's so just
from Iowa City, out of, it's a 80 miles that it'll go out.
Wow.
People bring it to the city.
And a regular route gets
the or? Actually, it does a little of both. It does a regular route, but it also does a call.
You can call it,
It's scheduled.
I would think that all those people in those huge pickup trucks in the country, they're going to be the last ones to be interested in.
I thought that, but you know who bought most of the F-150 lanes? The guys with pickup trucks in the country. That vehicle has a 0 to 60 of 6,000 miles. Until they had to get that charge it every day.
Cool. All right. Anything else, Ray? And then we'll shift over to Susan.
The one word that we aces, we kind of hang on is democratization of mobility. There are people whose economic poverty is based on they have no mobility. They can't get places they need, they can't get food. And I think the city of Madison has looked at the Park Street area. They were going to, Kohl's is going to move out of there. I'd say it's going to move out of there. And they went and they got a bidet to move into the building that's next to Merkel's. You can tell them. So, you know, I think that's one of the things we have to really pay attention to is we make sure mobility is there for everybody, because we can raise people out of their economic doldrums by giving them a way to get to a job. Mm-hmm. I think I'm going to refer to Roger because I know the stat is going across your lips anymore. What is the stat for if you, the amount of miles to your job, how it changes your economic status?
Yeah, it was a Harvard, it was a longitudinal study by Harvard. Circa 2017 is when they came out the first report. I think it's been confirmed in this last 5 years, but the your commute time is a bigger determinant of your economic mobility than at the time they were holding growing up in a two-parent household, high school test scores, and I think crime was another variable. So commute time, in other words, your economic, and think about it. I mean, if you're somebody who has to get on a bus, commute an hour to the factory, then go to your evening, get on another bus, commute an hour to get to your evening community college class to get your college degree, you know, this is a complicated existence. And so, yes, this is a study that I think also it was, they kind of updated the numbers in 2022. It was sort of the last round. It continued to confirm this. The commute time is a bigger determinant in economic upward mobility than these other variables that I mentioned.
And think about it once. If you live in a food desert and you don't have access to frozen foods, mm-hmm. and all you have is fast food, and to get groceries and to get them in the quantity you need them, you have to have substantial carrying capability. Mm-hmm. And if you have to go miles to do that, it's really hard. It's really hard to be able to bring that many groceries back or to be feeding them, you have full cancer center. So we need to really look at how we supply fresh food to areas that are economically disadvantaged so that we can get nutrition to the, especially the young kids and to the families that are in this area.
Great.
That's it.
All right. Thank you, Ray. The floor is yours.
I'm going to sit down.
Yes.
Because I wasn't sure where Ray was going to go with this and where I could come in. And I'm probably going to change the direction of this talk a little bit. But I will talk first about democratization. And I'll talk about scooters. We do have scooters in Mass. All you have to do is drive along... what's the road? University Bay Drive. Now, when you get up and you start going around... by the Observatory Drive, the scooters are there. And they're coming down the hills. And University Avenue going west is full. The bike lanes are full of scooters. And I don't know if the scooters are anyplace else in Madison, because there are a few observations that I've looked at. And one is that you need a really smooth, upgraded road for suitable for bicycles to be able to work with scooters reasonably safely. And most of the people who buy scooters are young men. And they usually have better than average incomes. So we have a lot of scooters in certain areas of Madison. But I'm not sure we have any scooters on Park Street, do we?
I can't think of any.
I have never seen a scooter on Park Street. And yet there is a regulation in the state of Wisconsin that says a scooter is to be treated as a bicycle. So it can ride on the highway, or it can, not on the highway, it can ride on the same street.
Or the bike lane.
And the bike, well, it doesn't have to ride in the bike lane. It can ride like a bicycle, but it can't go more than certain numbers of miles an hour. I think it might be 15 in Madison, but there are some places where scooters can go 30 miles an hour. And the city licenses them and regulates them. But in terms of democratization, what it doesn't appear to do in Madison is encourage the scooter companies to make scooters available in low-income communities at a discount rate. And those are two different things, making available in low-income communities and also making available at a discounted rate as a way of supplementing transportation for people who don't have any regular means of transportation. Now, the other thing I can say about scooters is Madison has not figured out that scooters are one way of getting people to use transit if they provide places for the scooters to stay. Or for the bicycles. You can put your bicycle on a bus, but if you just want to leave your bus at the stop where you get on and you get off, there's no mechanism for doing that. So there are a lot of these human elements that come to play. The other thing I think is important to think about, there is a new set of data available to the public from a company called, the company is actually funded by universities and the insurance industry and the housing industry, but it is a place where you can go and see what your risk factor is. It's called riskfactor.com. And it will look at your address, and if you go to the 50-year flood or 100-year flood, you will also see, if you look carefully enough, you will see what roads are going to make it impossible for you to drive through the water. Now, we haven't talked about water. We haven't talked about climate change. And that's something I've been thinking a lot about. But one of the things I would suggest for anybody who's ever thought about am I going to be able to drive out of this flood is go to riskfactor.com, put in your address. Last time I looked at this free, and you can go for flooding. They can tell you what your flood risk is. But if you look further, it will also show you your neighborhood. And you can start to figure out, I can walk out of my house and I can walk along the high part of the hills on my street. But if I go over too far, I'm not going to be able to drive because the other side of the hill is going to be flooded. And I tried to figure out one day, how would I get to my friend's house in Bishop's Bay? I don't think I could if there were a flood. I could walk all over my immediate part of the hill, but I couldn't. I'd have a little bit of old Middleton Road I might be able to drive on, but then I'd get to the point where I couldn't drive any further because there's all this water going to be in the way with this level of flooding. Mm. So I think about flooding, and then I think about roads. What shape are these roads going to be in? And I think you and I talked a little about what's going to happen to roads, because roads are very expensive to maintain. And if they're maintaining to the level of information you're able to give states, they're really expensive, because you could have the most fabulous road in the world with 1 millimeter resolution, but somebody has to pay for that. And that is exactly what you were talking about. So there are some doctrines that are coming into being. Madison prides itself as being one of the most sustainable cities in the country. Well, who knows? But sustainability has actually been defined by the United Nations with these various international conferences that have grown out of the Paris Agreement. And sustainability, in simple terms, is the ability to bounce right back and continue what you were doing. But sustainability has much more elongated definitions in terms of transportation, in terms of infrastructure, in terms of industrialization, in terms of food. So Madison has all these sustainability principles, but who knows what they're really doing, because it's not a very transparent community as far as sustainability goes. But I saw just the other day that, now this group had a speaker about a year and a half ago about the Arctic Circle melting, the permafrost melting. And I thought it was interesting that Canada has now issued a report saying that half of the roads in the northern part, Canada, will be unusable in 30 years because they're just basically going to collapse, erode. And, one answer might be gravel, and I think there's been gravel suggested for many other roads, where roads are just kind of disappearing. But we also know that some roads are going to disappear in areas where seawater is coming in. And the Florida Keys are losing some of their roads. There are roads in Virginia that are problematic. And there is a lot of question about how are you going to get rid of these roads? How are you going to turn them back? How are you going to deal with the property owners who say, I need that road to be able to get to my house? Well, those are some of the questions that look at us in the future. So there's a picture that I'm drawing from what you're talking about, Bray, that suggests that we may be able to live within our communities very well, but as roads deteriorate, as infrastructure costs skyrocket because of water destroying the roads or cold changing, heat changing the capability of roads. I'm no engineer, but I know that if the road gets too hot, it's going to buckle or it's going to develop looping or it's going to have this problem or that problem. But with all of these problems, I think that people who love to drive, and I love to drive in the country too, may find it's going to be very different driving in the future, especially on those back roads, because they're not going to be. The back roads and the hilly roads are the wonderful roads I like to drive on.
Right.
And I don't think those roads are going to be very available unless you have a motorized bicycle that's designed to go on back roads.
ATV,
thank you. So that's one set of comments I have. We might as well talk about climate change and emissions, because the United States has the highest, we have the second highest rate of total emissions in the world. But transportation, we are number one as transportation is our, we are the top emitter of transportation. Whereas China is not as high, they do electricity and heat and generation of electricity with coal. But we send all of our gases out, our greenhouse gases out through transportation, which is representing basically 29% of all the emissions that come out of the United States. And something like 60% of those emissions come from cars. And, well, it becomes a little cloudy, but there's a very large portion also comes out of freight, the trucks, the big trucks, which also spill out the black smoke, which has the nitrous oxide and the tiny pollutants that figure in the evening forecasts of what the air quality index is going to be the next day. So we have some work to do in terms of how we're going to readdress our transportation. And I know part of the idea of autonomous vehicles is that they would be electric. And there are a lot of other electrifiable vehicles that are talked about, but I don't know how much we're going to be driving. There's also the question with these some of these ride-hailing, and especially the scooters, are people actually going to be using transportation more instead of walking when they could simply get someplace faster? If they get somewhere 10 minutes faster walking from Vilas Hall out to the Ag campus, for instance. So are we going to be displacing walking with some of these autonomous vehicles and certainly with kids who like to ride those scooters? I don't know.
What about bikes? I know there's
bikes.
We live on Odana Road.
Bikes are wonderful.
But there are so many younger people that are riding bikes. We have young neighbors who have small children, and they've all got the little carts behind, and they take their kids to daycare and pick them up. And I'm amazed.
Well, bikes have no emissions.
But they
require pedaling.
But I mean, it seems to me that I see a lot more bikes and people riding bikes and people in their, 20s, 30s riding bikes than you do.
I think that's very true.
In fact, I was at Target today, and I don't know if I was just picking up groceries because that's how I get left my basics. And there was a bike with what looked like a rickshaw behind it, but it was a covered rickshaw. And I thought, well, is there a child in there? No, this man was taking groceries now, whether he was delivering them for Target or whether he was just taking them home and that was his method of conveyance. I don't know. But we may all be having to learn how to ride a bike again, learn how to pedal a bike.
They are kind of,
again,
to a great extent, seasonally limited. However, yes, there are people who, you know, in winter will stick it out and ride the fat tires and all that.
And that's right.
But I think there's that's a small percentage of the people who would be riding bikes otherwise.
But the other problem with bikes, we have, as you're mentioning, is if we have too many bikes. I remember being in China in 1981, and man, you'd see these bikes, you'd think, this is the horde. Mm-hmm. This is the Mongolian horde of bicyclers, and they all had their little Mao caps on. When they came, they went zoom, all in unison.
You went from 1992 in Beijing, looking out of your hotel window, to a big street, you'd see 100 bicyclers, but one car.
Mm-hmm.
2010, you see 100 cars and one bicycle.
Yes.
And that was downtown Beijing.
And in downtown Beijing in 1991, you wouldn't see any cars.
Yeah. Right.
It was scary.
There was also no economy.
Well, that's
exactly. I just was going to echo your point. I think you're spot on that if you care about climate, you got to care about transportation. And the joke, actually, when Biden came in and passed the Infrastructure and Jobs Act, was for the first time in, you know, modern history, suddenly the transportation secretary mattered, right?
Yes.
Pete Buttigieg all of a sudden was the star on Capitol Hill because he had all this money that now he was sending out to the states. So I think you're spot on. I mean, that number, the 29%, the greenhouse gas, the source of transportation sector is the biggest emitter of all other sectors in the United States. And
buses are not particularly good in terms of what they put out in terms of greenhouse gases. If you want to have very low emissions, you need rails.
Well, we got
but we don't have.
But don't you have to look at per person?
Yeah. Electric buses.
Yeah, how efficient are those e-buses?
Actually, pretty good. Although to charge one of the new e-buses, I think it takes like 4 giant chargers to do it. So if you go out to the new bus barn, they have to plug in 4 different places in order to get those batteries charged for the next day. But airplanes are a big one.
Airplanes are a very big problem.
But the biggest sector is the just personal automobiles.
Yes.
That's 60%. And I think that's why, by the way, Biden, one of the big prioritizations was funding electric buses in cities, which actually funded our electric buses here.
Yep.
Beside the roads. You know, that's these big fleet vehicles. He pumped a lot of money into fleet vehicle transitioning fleet vehicles like buses to electric all over the country.
Now, look, we haven't started to look at here in the United States, but France has just recently decided they are not allowing short-haul airplane flights. They want you to take the train. Mm-hmm. And apparently the starting of an airplane is the most, it puts out the most emissions. So actually the average per kilometer or average per mile flight emission of an airplane declines the longer the trip is, which is a nice little thing to know. But the short-haul flights are very problematic, and France is banning them for short-haul flights.
But you can actually get places on a train in France.
And so does every other country in Europe.
They're all small countries.
The problem with city driving, I'm guessing, is it must be the least efficient.
Yeah, sure.
Because so much stop and start and standing.
That's where a hybrid comes in. You know, if you have a hybrid, you can run on electric.
I don't mean to small country or a large country, but I used to go to my grandparents from southern Indiana to the middle of Nebraska. We would go to Chicago, we would drive to Chicago, and then we would get on the San Francisco Zephyr at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And at 3 in the morning, riding in the dome cars under the stars, there would be a special stop for us so my uncle could meet us in the middle of the snowfields and take us to grandmother's house.
Wow.
Now, we didn't have a sleigh, but we did have a complicated trip. And there was a train that went not too far from where grandmother lived, but there aren't that many places where there's enough ridership for trains. Well, so that's part of our
problem. That. I mean, I live near Julesburg, Colorado, and if anybody knows where that is, if you're going across country and go up to Denver. And we used to go in at 5 o'clock in the morning, and they'd flag stop the train.
Yes,
let's
call the flag stop.
Well, the train rails in this country, I think, peaked in 1900. And after that, literally, but you know.
That they didn't stop doing more.
Well, I mean, think of it. That's when cars just start coming in, you know, it's one of those things. And now, of course, we got all these great bike trails where the trains used to run.
Right.
But the other thing I will say is that bike stops were not only in rural areas. My neighborhood has been going through some potential transition, and we've been hearing a lot about the history of the when the Highlands were developed in 1911. There was a train, and there still is a train. It comes down behind, you all know where it comes.
Old Middleton,
and then it goes down along University Avenue. Yeah. And they would stop at the intersection of Old Middleton and the Highlands where the people who wanted to go down to the university, and they would just jump on the train and then go down. So we've lost a lot of potential by regulation and by systematizing some of these things. So the only other thing I'll say is there are some bright spots. One of the bright spots is that freight is starting to move towards sailing ships, not sailing ships, ships with lots of sails. Some of them electronic sails. Cargill and the EU retrofitted a very large cargo ship, presumably carrying grain or something else that cargo ships around the world. And that's going to be a sailing ship. That is a sailing ship. It's kind of ugly. It looks more like smokestacks. But there are several Swedish companies making sailing ships or sailing freight carriers. And there are companies in South America who are also experimenting. And Denmark has even done this with a ferry, which has worked out very well for them. And so they're now saying, well, we're going to start putting sails on our ships. So at least we can end with a bright spot.
Welcome back to 1850s.
Yeah.
Welcome back to beautiful sailing ships.
Yeah. I have one question. We were talking about roads in Canada. Were you sort of saying that we may need, like, more in the countryside, more gravel roads than paved roads, or just roads that are going to disappear altogether?
Well, I think both. If an area has a lot of water coming in, those will eventually disappear. But how quickly they'll disappear is a question and is a subject of an extremely long law review in the Stanford Law Review. Which suggests, among other things, that we're going to have to change our constitutional rights on takings, because people will argue that if you take away the road that I've had all these years, you've taken something of value to me. And of course, we'll have to fight that out between 2020 and 2080 until the roads are all washed away.
I was wondering, because I was so shocked when we moved to Wisconsin, because I grew up in western Nebraska, and none of our roads were country roads were paved.
Right.
No, and we're here, and I said, "Oh my goodness,
Wisconsin
moving the milk." But
at one time, Wisconsin had farm to market roads, and they made an investment to make sure that the farms could get to market.
Yeah.
Iowa's even more that way. There are very few gravel roads in Iowa when there's farms involved. In fact, some of them are concrete roads. That's how important it was for Iowa to be able to get stuff into.
I think Nebraska's still all gravel roads and a lot of Colorado.
That's
Thank you. Thank you so much, everybody. We have a few minutes to chat. There's refreshments out there, and we have a hard stop at 9 at Westminster. Mm-hmm. So thanks again for a great evening, Ray and Susan. And,
Be nice.
Thank you.
By the way, this is what LiDAR looks like. I did a mesh between the Capitol. We actually shot this the last year Scott Walker was in office. And we got kicked off the grounds. Scanned the Capitol down to 2-centimeter resolution, and then we meshed it with the photos that we had there.
Did they confiscate your LiDAR machine because they thought it was seditious?
They thought we were trying to get some information or something. You can't, actually, there's a law. I think this is you can't gather at the Capitol if you're not related or. That would affect after Act 10.
Candles.